What is going on? Welcome in, beautiful people. Buck Rising here with you till 1 o'clock on 104.5 The Zone. Thirsty Thursday. The weather may be a little bit dull, a little bit cloudy outside, but we're still going to have great effort and great energy for the next 3 hours. Lucas Panzeca making the show happen behind the glass. We have a great guest lineup, a lot of exciting topics, and we welcome your involvement throughout. 615-737-1045 is the number, 615-737-1045. Charles Davis, CBS Sports, he's going to be here coming up next. He's on the call with Ian Eagle for the Titans and the Chiefs on Sunday at Nissan Stadium. So we welcome the VFL's presence here in just about, 16 minutes from now? So stick around. But we got to start with baseball this morning, shall we? You got two teams that are one win away from the World Series. You got the Braves, potentially, if they can close out against the Dodgers, and if Houston can take care of business against the Red Sox, you're looking at a Braves-Astros World Series. Now, last night, to watch Braves fans after what was debilitating is the wrong word for Game 3, but you didn't like the way that it went down. You didn't like the way that you gave up the lead. You had the ability to further your stranglehold on the defending world champions, and you let them off the hook. Last night was the exact opposite, and it could not have been more impressive than what the Braves did to the Dodgers in L.A. 9-2 in that game. This baseball postseason has been, for me at least, and I'm just speaking from personal experience, I've been in and out throughout the course of it, just kind of keeping track of the fact that, okay, the Astros are going to continue to win despite the cheating. And, look, they're going up against the other cheaters in the ALCS against the Boston Red Sox. That ought to be fun. Who's more hateable out of that? And then you have the lovable Atlanta Braves, and you have the hated Los Angeles Dodgers. And, I got dragged pretty summarily when I said that I was rooting for Mookie Betts above all because Braves fans didn't like that. And I understand why. You're rooting for your team as opposed to individual players, even if Mookie Betts is Nashville's favorite son. But I wonder how closely everybody else has been following the championship series in Major League Baseball right now, because it's been smothered by all things football, at least from my standpoint. Now, it seems like certainly once we got to the championship series, I know my interest picked up. And I think a part of that is because I'm so curious to see, or I have been curious to see, the reaction to Houston and Boston specifically. Because they had the scandals around both of them. What was that, 2019? Everything kind of gets, I don't want to say swept under the rug, but you get lost in a lot of what was happening with COVID and the baseball season, given that they were the first ones to kind of wade into this mess while everything else was shut down. So you're looking at two still hated franchises in professional baseball at this point, but they're exciting to watch. Boston fans, I find Boston sports fans to be a special kind of unlikable. But their team, I think, has a lot of redeeming qualities, even if they didn't go through the regular season the way that you like. Their postseason has been exciting. And then I think everybody, do people still hate Houston? Do people still hate the Astros with that kind of passion?
Until the end of time.
Now, you just said that very definitively. You're not any kind of giant baseball fan, are you?
No, I think that's a universal thing. Whenever the Astros are playing or whenever they get this far in the postseason.
Just because of the trash cans?
Oh, yeah, 100%. And just the way that they botched everything, in the aftermath, it felt like even Rob Manfred, it's not exclusive to the Astros, everybody involved just kept saying the wrong thing.
Oh, yeah. No, it was just a constant tripping and stumbling over each other to try and get the right message out.
What did Manfred say about, the World Series?
Oh, he said it about
it like a hunk of metal.
He said it about the trophy. Yeah. The commissioner of the sport was like, yeah, it's just a hunk of metal.
You imagine Roger Goodell talking about the Lombardi.
Roger Goodell physically throws himself in front of the Lombardi on a day-to-day basis to maintain the sanctity and quote-unquote purity of the National Football League. Rob Manfred's looking at the World Series trophy like, yeah.
I don't know what the big deal is.
Just a hunk of metal.
Did you stay up the whole game?
For the Braves? Yeah, no, I stayed up a lot, like, because I thought about going to bed.
If it was anybody else, would you have gone to bed?
I would have gone to bed.
Yeah, not doing that. No, I considered staying up.
100%. Oh, you didn't stay up?
No, after Rosario's second homer to make it a 9-2 lead, I that's when I called it. But I said, you know, if this was ever going to be a game, it would be the Braves.
You got to talk a lot less than I do today. You're off the hook as far as that's concerned. But yeah, Rosario has been incredibly clutch throughout the course of this postseason, and he was red hot last night, sealing that 9-2 win for Atlanta. But I wonder how many people are experiencing the baseball postseason like we are, because that's the opportunity for baseball to draw, and it just so happens that they run smack dab into the middle of the NFL season, and you hate that for baseball because I think it deserves a lot more attention. But am I going to spend as much of my bandwidth focusing on baseball if, you know, the Titans have just beaten the Bills and now the AFC looks a lot more interesting and this is happening in 31 other NFL markets as well? Maybe more, because baseball's always been regional this way, or at least in the last decade it's been a lot more regional this way. So I wonder how many people are experiencing the postseason like we are as a show, where it's just like, yeah, you know, I'll keep an eye on it. It looks like the Braves got things in hand. I'm a knockoff because they're playing on the West Coast and this is taking entirely too long, as it should. Or if you're just excited about that because you're an Atlanta Braves fan and you're on the precipice. You're a game away from the World Series.
Game away. What could go wrong?
Well, I mean, is it wrong that I'm rooting for things to go wrong just to watch Will Bowling squirm? Is that mean?
I think that qualifies. That nasty? I think that qualifies as mean. I think it falls into that category.
Yeah, but that's the fun of sports. You want to see your friends' sport, your favorite teams, fall flat on their face, don't you? I mean, that's the nature of male intimacy, is when something that you love comes crashing down in dramatic fashion, then all of your buddies are not there to pick you up, but point and laugh at you afterwards, like Texas fans against Oklahoma. I wasn't looking to pat my my Texas friends on the back after they gave up that touchdown as time expired. I wanted to point and laugh at them. In fact, I did that over text message. I think that's what makes sports fun, or at least that's how I think sports are fun.
Wanting anyway. People to be miserable.
Oh yeah, sure.
That's a big part of it.
It's a lot of. I think that people get a sick kind of enjoyment out of it, even if that's not the way that they want to describe it. Anyway. We will we'll keep tabs on that. Obviously, the Braves will play the Dodgers later tonight, 7 o'clock Central Time, with that 3-1 lead. The ability to close out, and we put it up on a poll. Do you trust them to do it, especially after how last season went in the championship series and kind of petering out at the end? In the meantime, we'll pivot to some Titans talk because Charles Davis is going to join us. CBS Sports, of course, VFL. He's on the Titans preseason broadcast as well. Him and Ian Eagle have the call of the Titans and the Chiefs this Sunday at Nissan Stadium. So we'll catch up with Charles coming up next. I'm Buck Rising. It's 104.5 The Zone. Welcome back. Buck Rising here with you till 1 o'clock. A lot of stuff happening in the world of the NFL, and particularly here in Nashville on Sunday at Nissan Stadium. Charles Davis of CBS Sports, the NFL on CBS, joins us now. He, Ian Eagle, Evan Washburn, they're going to be on the call for this particular AFC showdown. Charles, how we living, boss?
Hey, we're doing okay. How are you doing, Buck? It's good to hear your voice again.
Man, it's good to talk to you. I hope everything's going well. Everything is fantastic here. Certainly feels a lot better at 4-2 than it would at 3-3 if you're a Titans fan. And I know that is going to make a difference playoff time as the Titans and the Chiefs get closer and closer to the postseason. But for this particular game, Charles, I guess just from a 1,000-foot view, what most intrigues you about these two teams squaring off?
Well, to me, it's just sometimes you just want to get simple with it, Buck. And to me, it's Derrick Henry. If this game stays within range either way, right? 30 carries?
No.
Minimum.
Easy.
Okay? Minimum. You're looking at a defense, a run defense that has not proven itself. It's been gashed by a number of teams along the way. You're getting some guys back, they hope, in Chris Jones, but he hasn't played in a couple of weeks at defensive line. You're going to test them. So if you are a linebacker or a secondary player in Kansas City, this has not been a fun week, because if guys get married up on the blocks up front and he gets a run, now you're making – forget the, you know, the joke about business decisions. There are no business decisions to be made. You have to go put your body on him.
Right.
And over four quarters, that's not a lot of fun. And bottom line is, if you're not willing to engage him for four quarters, you know what he does to people. So to me, that's what this game really truly comes down to. If Kansas City can't sprint away from them early, right, if they can't come out of the gate, like if you're a horse racing fan, I learned this from my friend Randy Moss over at NBC, a good start out of the gate is called, he caught a flyer out of the gate. And Kansas City doesn't catch that flyer, or they can't pull away, and Tennessee can keep that game in range and the run game stays intact, then you're going to – I can't imagine Todd Downing's offensive coordinator doesn't test them 30-plus runs with Derrick Henry.
The workload continues to be ridiculous for him. Every week, it seems, Charles, we come out of one of these games with Derrick Henry has done X, Y, and Z for the first time as an NFL running back since Jim Brown, or – just some of these incredible Hall of Fame NFL greats across the decades, and I keep waiting for football to happen to Derrick Henry, but in a sport full of giant, tough, insane people, he seems to be bigger, stronger, faster than all of them. I don't know what the precedent is for him at this point.
Yeah, it's a great question. To me, the precedent is probably Earl Campbell. To keep it within the franchise, the precedent is Eddie George. Heavy workloads, how long can it go? And then one day they show up at camp, Buck, and someone, a longtime observer of the team, goes, "Ooh, old Derek's taking it easy in camp this year, huh? Yeah. Easing himself into it." Because they've seen that before. And what that usually means is, guess what? The accumulated hits have finally taken its toll. That's what happened to Campbell. I mean, all of a sudden Earl went from running through Isaiah Robertson to he couldn't run. You know, Eddie, as great a player as he was, at a certain point, it catches up with you, and you're not the same guy. Here's what I keep coming back to, though, Buck. I had to do a little bit of research, right? I got a master's in history, so I better put it to use occasionally, right? At Alabama, his first year, I think he had 35 carries. I think he got into the low 100s or, like, you know, 170 or something his second year. His third year, he jumped to 395. And yeah, you remember down the stretch in the college football playoff, he was about getting about 40 touches a game, remember?
Yeah.
He gets to the Titans first few years. Wasn't much of a workload, was there? So his odometer is a little bit different for his age and for the experience in the game than it would be for a person who was a full-time, like – that's what made Emmitt Smith so remarkable to me. High school, college, NFL, he never had a year, quote unquote, where he wasn't the guy. And they didn't shovel it to him, you know, on almost every running play. So his longevity was off the charts as far as I was concerned, because it was longevity and productivity for a lot longer than you would expect. I think for Derrick Henry, those days he was frustrated not getting the ball, maybe paying off for him a little bit now, Buck, because obviously the workload has really started to increase. But prior to that, it wasn't anywhere close to what you would expect out of a guy of his caliber.
Yeah, and I think that's been kind of the thing that most people have been surprised by, is that it's really rather recent, his success, since about halfway through the 2018 season when he started to become the full-time starter under this Vrabel coaching staff. But we know the narratives, we know the storylines. Charles Davis of the NFL on CBS here with us on 104.5 The Zone. Of course, you can watch him, Ian Eagle, and Evan Washburn on the call locally on News Channel 5 and across the CBS Sports Network. Let's talk about the matchup, Charles, because I thought it curious the way that the Bills came out against this Titans offense. They stayed with nickel primarily, it seems, as their foundational defense, even against the Titans' 12 and 21 personnel sets. What did you make of Buffalo's approach to the Titans' offense and how the Titans went about attacking it?
Well, I think that Leslie Frazier, the defense coordinator, Sean McDermott, their head coach, who, you know, his background is full defense. I think they looked at their roster and said, our best players, our best defenses, even if it doesn't look right, are these guys on the field. You know, sometimes, Buck, you can look at things and say to yourself, here's the right game plan. But if the wrong guys are playing, that's worse than playing what you normally do anyway. Sure. Because let's face it, if you're going to adjust against Tennessee, I mean, Washington last week, we had Kansas City, Washington last week. Washington likes to play five down defensive linemen at times. That would be ideal against Tennessee until they prove otherwise. Because now you're saying, okay, we're going to get big bodies in there, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the five that they're playing are legit five. Okay, four first-round picks and Matt Ioannidis, who was a third-round pick, but plays at a very high level. But if you don't have those people, and now you're trying to sub in guys and go, hey, this is my second and third-line guy, but the right thing to do is to get bigger bodies on the field, but yet he can't hold up anyway, I think you're better off playing your regular base defense and telling everybody, we know your big boy pads have been ordered, strap them on, and let's see if we can get it going. Because it's a catch-22 on that one. Play something you're unfamiliar with guys who aren't up to the task, or play what you're familiar with and then have to deal with the consequences of if they're able to keep beating on you and banging on you. The kicker to me in that game, Buck, if you go back and look at the stats, which I know you have, and you took names off of it, is there any way you saw Tennessee winning that game in the stats against Buffalo when it was all said and done?
Absolutely not.
Because there wasn't a – you know, there's usually – when stats are tilted one side up for a team, there's usually a nullifier, an equalizer, meaning turnovers, something like that, right? Tennessee would have gotten five takeaways or something, right, to nullify. That didn't even happen.
Right.
Not that they didn't get takeaway, but it wasn't tilted into their advantage. That was a gritty, tough, hang in there, make plays when you had to effort that really – fits what Mike Vrabel does. And in a lot of ways, Buck, I see that game as getting back what happened in New York against the Jets.
Yeah. I mean, you know this, Charles. The world was ending here in Nashville after they lost to a winless Jets team. And in fact, Lucas, if we could put that on the poll, does Mike Vrabel want every game to come down to fourth and short? Because I'm convinced he does. You can't tell me otherwise, Charles.
You know what I think about, Buck, when you said that? The name Steve Prefontaine.
Okay.
For those who may not remember Steve Prefontaine, he was our preeminent long-distance runner in the United States in the 70s. At the University of Oregon, ran in the Munich Olympics, finished fourth, liked to be a front runner, didn't like people, you know, crowding him in. His thing was always you run till you drop. You don't run tactically, right?
Right.
His was always that. And he said before the Munich games, I wanted to come down to a guts race because if it does that, I'm the only one who can win it. Doesn't that sound like Mike Vrabel?
It absolutely does. This is why Charles Davis is the best. Historical context for me making a dumb joke while he's on the air with us. let's take a look at the Titans offense, Charles, because this was something that I think was the closest we've seen to their full complement of skill position players being available. We know that Julio Jones obviously didn't finish. We know that A.J. Brown is still not operating at 100%. But I was stunned by the amount of three wide receiver sets that the Titans ended up running. 37 snaps, 73% of their offensive plays came out of 11 personnel. How close is this, do you think, just from your observations of seeing some Titans games so far this year, limited with the injury report that they've had, and now seeing what it was supposed, or a closer measure of what we think Todd Downing wants to do?
Yeah, I think that, you know, what it told us, I believe, Buck, is that they have capable guys that they believe in behind Julio and AJ, and it's not going to alter what Todd Downing wants to do on offense. Meaning, I'm not sure how many of us went into the season and thought Chester Rogers, Nick Westbrook, Akina, you know, are going to be those kind of guys that when the game's on the line, you're still going to call offense the same way. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Yet, what did we see in this ball game? The last drive, the go-ahead score, which turned out to be the game-winning score, Westbrook Akina, three catches, 27 yards, his first three catches of the night. Obviously, A.J. battled hard, being sick and playing in that game and coming off of injury. Julio went, and then the hamstring went. But Rodgers gave them some play. Batson gets hurt, so now you've got to dig even deeper. I'm really still waiting for Firkser at tight end. I don't know how much the injuries have played into it. I really thought this would be kind of preseason. I said Dawson Knox would be a breakout player for Buffalo. So occasionally you get one right, Buck?
Nailed it.
I thought Firkser would be similar, if that makes sense. But I know he's been battling some injuries and trying to, you know, battling through some stuff. But I still think if he gets healthy, that's another weapon that I think will be utilized, and that may be one of those surprise things down the road. But what I've gathered out of it is that Todd Downing believes in those guys enough that he's not going to have to alter things if he likes the matchups out wide, if he likes being able to spread the field a little bit to keep giving some running lanes to Derrick Henry. All those things still kick into place. And to me, that's huge for Tennessee, because now they're not announcing to the world that, hey, if there's no AJ and no Julio, guys, guess what? We're going back to darn near single wing, and the whole game's going to be played within the college hash marks. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what you're going to do.
Yeah, and that's exactly how they've been having to play with the limited personnel that they've had available to them. Give my Hoosier the
question.
Go ahead.
Ask your question, because you follow this team as well as anyone. When the game came down to Buffalo having the ball on the last drive and Mike Vrabel's not using timeout, did anything flash through your head, like it did mine?
I would say, I'd call a timeout, Mike, is what we were screaming in the press box. To be honest with you,
well, you know what flashed through my head?
What's that?
Super Bowl, New England, Seattle. Down the stretch, everyone's screaming for New England to take their timeouts on defense. Seattle's marching. Bill Belichick never takes the timeout. Felt like Seattle wasn't quite organized on their side. Felt like he was. Waited for him to make the fatal mistake. Instead of running it in, they threw it. They make the play. This ball game, Mike Vrabel, all I saw after the game was he said, I felt like we would hold him to three. So at worst, he's in overtime, right?
Right.
He doesn't call the timeout. Same thing. The fourth down play when Buffalo decided to go for it, because I know it's after the game, but I'm screaming at the TV, so I'll take a lie detector anywhere. Kick the field goal. I know what the analytics told me, Buck. But I'm screaming kick the field goal to Buffalo. You know why? Because Tennessee's defense was beat up.
Yeah.
I take it to overtime. I know Tennessee's offense was hot. I'm not stupid. I watched the game. But I'm taking my chance with Josh Allen and my crew at overtime and not losing it here. Now, I understood why he did it. In most cases, he's going to be successful. It's a sneak. It's, what, a half a yard, whatever it was, Josh Allen. But remember how they hurried to the line of scrimmage, Buck?
Oh, it looked panicked.
Okay, now here's the kicker to that for me. I don't hurry at that point for this reason. They know you're coming on fourth down.
Yeah.
You're not surprising them rushing to the line of scrimmage. Take your time. Make sure you got it set. And maybe his footing's better. But they rushed. They got stuffed. Great play by Jeffrey Simmons. Don't take that away from it. And does that now, to me, it equals what we saw in that Super Bowl? Wait for your opponent to make the mistake. They don't seem quite as together as maybe you might think. And Mike Vrabel had enough confidence and chutzpah to hang in there. And boy, did it pay off in a big way. His team rewarded him. That's what I was thinking during that time.
And here I thought that Mike Vrabel's biggest moment of trying to show the Bills some stones was the Music City Miracle recreation that they tried in the first half. But no, that's such brilliant insight from you, Charles. And I really appreciate you educating the offense and giving us, or the audience, and giving us that perspective, because I know exactly what you're talking about. In fact, I've seen, you know, NFL Network run the Super Bowl recaps or the Super Bowl specials after the fact on that a million times, and heard people talk about the fact that Bill Belichick is just silently waiting there with his timeouts, waiting for the opposite sideline to start to scramble, because why isn't Bill doing what he absolutely should be doing in that moment? That is not something at all that I had considered, but it makes all the sense in the world.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, I don't know that I'm right. I mean, I haven't talked with Mike yet. We'll talk this weekend and see what he has to say on that. And knowing Mike, he'll give me that look.
He'll snort at like, you and just stare through the Zoom.
He'll give me that look like, you know, have your theory, whatever, but that doesn't mean I got to co-sign anything. What else you got for me? You know? And frankly, that's one of the reasons that I'm a big admirer of him, because he could very well – let's say I'm right, Buck. Let's say there's a chance I'm right. If I say that to other coaches, you know what they do? They puff up pretty well. Yeah, get a little smile.
Yeah.
Act like they knew something the rest of the world didn't. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And Mike Vrabel doesn't play that game at all. It's like, I'm not going to tell you I'm smarter than anyone else. I'm just going to do things the way I think they should be done. And it worked out pretty well for him.
It's very, very on brand. And it's good to know that the look that he gives does not discriminate just to the local media.
Oh, no. It's an equal opportunity look, Buck. I mean, it's an equal opportunity look. We all get it. There's no question.
I've gotten that stare a million times before, Charles. I can feel it in my soul right now. Charles Davis, the NFL on CBS, VFL, kind enough to give us some of his time. I know you're busy this week, Charles. We appreciate it. And we'll certainly be watching on CBS this weekend as you guys call this Chiefs-Titans game. It's going to be very, very exciting. And I hope you guys get the half the atmosphere that was at, that was here in Nashville on Monday night, because that was something special.
That was special, and it was deserved, because they don't get many cracks at that primetime deal, and the fans turned out and showed the world. They've got a great football team, a great atmosphere. There'll be great atmosphere on Sunday as well. It's a terrific fan base. And for me, Buck, last thing, it's Bama week. And I realize we haven't had much success against Bama in a long time in Tennessee, but Bama week will always be special. And if you played in this rivalry, we're a part of it. And I know Bama people are like, what rivalry? Well, it's still a rivalry as far as we're concerned. I'm 56, Buck, and my body still reacts to Bama week.
I love
that.
That's
all I got to tell you.
100%. See, here I was going to open the interview by asking if it was you throwing the mustard bottle at Lane Kiffin, but I thought I would give you plausible deniability.
That would not be me, but I've had a bottle thrown at me in Neyland Stadium before on what people thought was a bad call, and it was a whiskey bottle.
Oh, God.
And straight on brand for my people, it was empty, because there's no way they're wasting a good slug to throw until they drain the bottle.
Amen. Well, enjoy the game on Saturday, and then, of course, the game that you'll be working on Sunday. We really appreciate you taking the time, Charles. I know the audience enjoys it as well.
Thanks a lot, Buck. It's always great chatting with you. Look forward to seeing you at the stadium on Sunday. You take care.
Absolutely. You too. Charles Davis, one of the best in the business, here with us on 104.5 The Zone. When we come back, I want to talk about some of the analysis that Charles gave us, and I want to take a look at what's happening potentially in the AFC South, because one of the biggest stories in sports today having to do with the NFL is what's happening with Deshaun Watson and potentially his movement to the Miami Dolphins. We'll give you the latest on that as reported by the Houston Chronicle, and we'll talk about how it impacts, really, the rest of the NFL potentially this season. That's up next. I'm Buck Rising. It's 104.5 The Zone. Charles Davis is the best in business. Him and Ian Eagle are going to kill it on Sunday doing this game for CBS Sports. So let's talk about what else is happening in the NFL, and we'll get back to the Titans here in a second, because the trade deadline is looming, and I do think that the Titans may be in the market for an acquisition of sorts, and I think that they may have some capital with which to acquire some help in the secondary, and I'll tell you what that is later on in the show. David Long, by the way, Titans linebacker, is going to join us at 11:15, so in about a half hour from now, we'll talk to him, and I'm sure he already had to answer questions about headbutting Josh Allen, but I'm sure we'll see if he won't be willing to have some fun with us about it when he hops on before practice today. So, Deshaun Watson, did anybody see this report from John McClain last night? I think it kind of got swept up in not a news dump type of way, because it's still during the week and normally this stuff picks up more traction. But John McClain, famously of the Houston Chronicle, he's covered the NFL for 45 years, which is a ridiculous amount of time. He was out there last night reporting that a deal for Deshaun Watson to be sent to the Miami Dolphins could be done this week. Now, the Houston Chronicle, unfortunately, and it's not like I'm unwilling to pay for journalism. I pay for the New York Times. I pay for the Wall Street Journal. I pay for a lot of things. I pay for the Athletic. You know, I'm not above paying for stuff, but this particular article is behind a paywall, so I went to ESPN because I knew that they would aggregate it and take the best parts of it and then put it in a story for themselves for their own traffic purposes. So what is basically happening is the only new information on this story is that the deal could be done this week. Now, what also has been circulated from multiple sources is that Tua Tagovailoa could be sent in a three-team trade, potentially, to the Washington football team, who, of course, does not have Ryan Fitzpatrick, who is probably just shaking a fist at the sun saying, I can't escape this guy. It was supposed to be his job this year, and then he gets hurt and injures, I think, a hip. And then loses his starting opportunity to Taylor Heinicke. Now, potentially, the guy who unseated him in Miami last year could end up as the Washington football team's quarterback. But for the purposes of this information, it's not new information. And so, as I'm working through this, nothing has changed from a legal standpoint, right? We haven't seen any new information about civil lawsuits potentially turning criminal. We have no idea whether what we're talking about with Deshaun Watson and the allegations of sexual assault and sexual harassment, whether they have the potential to turn criminal, whether that has the potential to yield jail time. All we know is that the NFL is just not doing anything with this guy. They're not suspending him. He's not on the commissioner's exempt list, which is just this nebulous place that they stash players like Adrian Peterson when he was accused of roughing up one of his children. Or Greg Hardy, I believe, was on the commissioner's exempt list for a period of time as well. When the league has problematic players and doesn't know what to do with them, typically that's where they end up. And I had not heard of it really until the Adrian Peterson situation a couple of years ago. But they haven't even done that with Deshaun Watson. Nobody knows, or at least nobody outside of the legal proceedings, has seen any movement on that front. So what's changed with the Dolphins that would bring about new information on this story? I think that's the biggest question that you got to ask yourself when you're looking at what John McClain is reporting about a deal potentially being done to send Deshaun Watson to Miami this week. Is it just the fact that the owner's pissed off that the Miami Dolphins, who are probably the most disappointing team in football this year? They were 10-6 a year ago. They're 1-5. They just lost to the damn Jacksonville Jaguars in London. So what happened? Are you just at this point languishing enough that you're willing to sacrifice, potentially, again, all of these are allegations until anything more concrete becomes of the Deshaun Watson situation. So are you potentially willing to sacrifice your morals just for wins? And the answer is inevitably yes, because this is the National Football League, after all, and morality is always trumped by the ability to get more wins, even if you're on a 1-5 miserable, stinky Dolphins football team. Is it the fact that you just straight up lost to Uncle Herb? You just gave creepy Uncle Herb and the Jacksonville Jaguars their first win of the season. Is that enough to move the needle to say, all right, for the owner to be like, enough of this bleep? Okay, Brian Flores, you were supposed to be the one good branch on the Bill Belichick tree, and that has since fallen flat on its face this season. Their roster is supposed to be appreciably better. For whatever reason, they've spent so many first-round picks on the offensive line in Miami, going back to, like, Jake Long and Marquise. Was it Marquise? Which Pouncey played for the Dolphins? Ramon Foster is probably going to get pissed at me because now I'm going to get them mixed up. I do this every time. Lucas is not the other one. Schaefer says he's. It was the other one, not Marquise. Thank you for all your good help. Mike, I got Schaefer in here. Mike Pouncey. I got Schaefer in here making himself a cup of coffee and doing a better job EPing the show than Lucas.
All right, you come in here.
Help me help you.
Schaefer, come on in, Schaefer. I'll head home.
Regardless, the Dolphins suck. Is that enough for the ownership group to be like, all right, the Tua experiment, had enough of it. I don't even think it's Tua's fault. If you watch that miserable 9:30 in the morning Jags-Dolphins game, because apparently we just were still finding ways to pay the United Kingdom back for 1776. It's not enough that we emancipated ourselves. We have to send them the worst possible NFL games every week to make sure that we're still sticking it to Big Brother at this point. The War of 1812. Can people? I love Schaefer as just a background
voice.
It's
distant, but it's there.
I love somebody just walking by the microphone and it just picking up the War of 1812 in the background. There he is on Zone TV for the people watching at home. But why are the Dolphins now in desperation mode? That's the biggest question about this. Is it so far gone that they're just like, all right, enough. If the Texans aren't going to do anything with this guy, why don't we? Does this not seem bizarre to you? 615-737-1045 is how you get involved. 615-737-1045. Now, this is starting to come back up because the trade deadline is what? Is it 13 days? 12 days from now, the NFL trade deadline, 3 p.m. Central Time. So it brings about a more local conversation. Do the Titans do anything at the deadline, given the state of their roster and given the nature of what this season is supposed to mean, this push that they're supposed to make? ESPN has put up on their website the best trade deadline projections, for lack of a better term. So I want to ask you guys, would you be willing to trade Josh Reynolds? I don't know that there would be any buyers for Josh Reynolds at this point. He's been a healthy scratch several times, and he's on a roster right now that doesn't, that of all the places that it lacks depth, the Tennessee Titans roster feels pretty comfortable about the wide receiver position if they can get Julio and AJ back on track. Would you be comfortable shipping off Josh Reynolds if you can find a buyer for him? And what would you want the Titans to acquire at the trade deadline 12 days from now? 615-737-1045 is the number. We'll talk about it coming up next. We'll take your phone calls as well. Don't forget the Titans linebacker David Long is scheduled to join us at 11:15. Mike Golic Jr. of ESPN at 12:20. It's 104.5 The Zone.